Good evening.
Is that Negra Medela?
Yes. Just keep talking.
Good evening, everyone. If I can have your attention for just a minute, please. We'd like to go ahead and kick off for this evening. Welcome, everyone, to this, the last Dallas Philosophers Forum lecture of this season. We will be taking the summer off since we more or less follow the academic year. And we'll be resuming back in September. We do have our fall schedule pretty much lined out, but not quite published yet. So check the website, please, which is easy to find, philosophersforum.org, for the details of the fall schedule. But it'll be, as usual, quite a variety and mixture of topics. So you should find something you like, if not everything. How many people are here for the first Philosophers Forum lecture tonight? Okay, great. Well, it's good to welcome some new faces, and hope you get to make some friends here, and hope to see you back. How did you find out about us? Meetup or friends?
Friends,
okay. That's great. We did get a lot of people coming to the meetup group as well. So I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker, who is one of our regular Philosophers Forum attendees, Mr. Wynn Galbraith, and he's had quite an interesting career. Was born in Chicago, but also lived in Japan, and wound up at MIT studying physics, but then he decided that wasn't challenging enough, so he wanted to study philosophy and physics together, and graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Philosophy and Physics, and then went on for a master's in theology from the Western Seminary in Holland, Michigan, and then went to Pittsburgh to study in the new joint program of the University of Pittsburgh and Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, where he managed to acquire not one, not two, but three doctorate degrees in philosophy, history and philosophy of science, and theology. So you got philosophy, science, theology, ethnobasis kind of all covered there. And so with that, then, he went on to become acting chairperson in all three of those areas and three departments, one of the regional campuses of the University of Pittsburgh. And then he still felt like he wasn't schooled enough, so he went and got a master's degree in information science, which I guess finally led to a non-academic paying career, because he then took a position as chief computer scientist with EIA, which produced environmental impact statements for corporations planning projects with environmental impacts, and was able to retire in 2004. So let's give a warm welcome to Mr. Wynn Galbraith, who will be addressing us on the topic, is capitalism stable and what does that mean?
Talk loud, Wynn.
Hey, hopefully I've got a microphone on. I don't have to talk loud. Am I coming through?
Yes.
Yeah, coming through. Can I be heard at the back?
No.
I just turn it up a little bit.
Yeah, we'll turn it up.
Maybe I should move this a little.
We'll get it adjusted. Just keep talking.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay.
No.
Was there a no? Okay.
Yeah. It went to sleep.
Let's see.
It changed your power button.
Hit the power button.
At the top there.
Okay, the top. I'm not going to turn it off. Okay, I'm turning it on.
Is it coming up?
I'm not going to have to put the password in, am I?
No.
Okay.
Did you push this?
Wait a minute. DPF locked.
We're just get the arrow and click one time. No. It's going to be right on that orange thing.
Okay,
get the arrow and click once.
Yeah. Right now. Okay. We're making progress. I want to start with a 5-minute video clip from YouTube, which presents some data on the inequality of wealth in the United States. That is a little old.
Oh, go ahead.
But it's something that is better presented than I can present it.
There's an article about it this morning, right?
Is there? Let's see. There we go.
most interesting to me is the reality compared to our perception.
Okay.
The ideal is as far removed from our perception of reality as the actual distribution is from what we think exists in this country. So ignore the ideal for a moment. Here's what we think it is again. And here is the actual distribution. Shockingly skewed. Not only do the bottom 20% and the next 20%, the bottom 40% of Americans barely have any of the wealth. I mean, it's hard to even see them on the chart. But the top 1% has more of the country's wealth than 9 out of 10 Americans believe the entire top 20% should have. Mind-blowing. But let's look at it another way, because I find this chart kind of difficult to wrap my head around. Instead, let's reduce the 311 million Americans to just a representative 100 people. Big and simple. Here they are. Teachers, coaches, firefighters, construction workers, engineers, doctors, lawyers, some investment bankers, a CEO, maybe a celebrity or two. Now let's line them up according to their wealth. Poorest people on the left, wealthiest on the right, just a steady row of folks based on their net worth. We'll color code them like we did before based on which 20% quintile they fall into. Now, let's reduce the total wealth of the United States, which was roughly $54 trillion in 2009, to this symbolic pile of cash. And let's distribute it among our 100 Americans. Well, here's socialism, all the wealth of the country distributed equally. We all know that won't work. We need to encourage people to work and work hard to achieve that good old American dream and keep our country moving forward. So, here's that ideal we asked everyone about. Something like this curve. This isn't too bad. We've got some incentive, as the wealthiest folks are now about 10 to 20 times better off than the poorest Americans. But hey, even the poor folks aren't actually poor, since the poverty line has stayed almost entirely off the chart. We have a super healthy middle class with a smooth transition into wealth. And yes, Republicans and Democrats alike chose this curve. 9 out of 10 people, 92%, said this was a nice, ideal distribution of America's wealth. But let's be honest. This is what people think America's wealth distribution actually looks like. Not as equitable, clearly, but for me, even this still looks pretty great. Yes, the poorest 20 to 30% are starting to suffer quite a lot compared to the ideal, and the middle class is certainly struggling more than they were, while the rich and wealthy are making roughly 100 times that of the poorest Americans, and about 10 times that of the still healthy middle class. Sadly, this isn't even close to the reality. Here is the actual distribution of wealth in America. The poorest Americans don't even register. They're down to pocket change. And the middle class is barely distinguishable from the poor. In fact, even the rich between the top 10 and 20 percentile are worse off. Only the top 10% are better off. And how much better off? So much better off that the top 2 to 5% are actually off the chart at this scale. And the top 1%, this guy, well, his stack of money stretches 10 times higher than we can show. Here's his stack of cash, restacked, all by itself. This is the top 1% we've been hearing so much about. So much green in his pockets that I have to give him a whole new column of his own, because he won't fit on my chart. 1% of America has 40% of all the nation's wealth. The bottom 80%, 8 out of every 10 people, or 80 out of these 100, only has 7% between them. And this has only gotten worse in the last 20 to 30 years. While the richest 1% take home almost a quarter of the national income today, in 1976, they took home only 9%, meaning their share of income has nearly tripled in the last 30 years. The top 1% owned half the country's stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. The bottom 50% of Americans own only 0.5% of these investments, which means they aren't investing. They're just scraping by. I'm sure many of these wealthy people have worked very hard for their money. But do you really believe that the CEO is working 380 times harder than his average employee? Not his lowest paid employee, not the janitor, but the average earner in his company. The average worker needs to work more than a month to earn what the CEO makes in 1 hour. We certainly don't have to go all the way to socialism to find something that is fair for hardworking Americans. We don't even have to achieve what most of us consider might be ideal. All we need to do is wake up and realize that the reality in this country is not at all what we think it is.
The data that you see here is actually from 2002, more than a decade old. And since then, it has gotten significantly worse. And I will show you some slides and try to update it a little bit towards the end of the presentation.
F5 should start it, there you go.
Yeah, that isn't what I wanted, but let's see. Here, first slide, just a title slide. What is the price of this inequality? Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winner, published a book, I think this is 2012, on the price of this inequality. And he points out that the gains at the top are far less than the losses at the bottom and the middle. And as a result of this inequality, we have slower growth than we would have otherwise. We have lower gross domestic product. We have more instability. We have more unemployment. We have weakened democracy. We have a diminished sense of fairness and justice, and we have a questioning of our sense of identity. Now, he also says there are arguments in support of the status quo. There is, for example, the equality efficiency trade-off argument, which says that when you get more of one, you get less of the other. There's also the idea that inequality is the inevitable consequence of any incentive system, and we have to adopt some sort of incentive system that's going to produce inequality. And any redistribution necessarily lessens incentives. So what we have is, in the United States, is equality of opportunity, not equality of results. At least that's the way the argument goes. Any government interference will result in diminishing tax revenues, which will hurt everyone. And in chapters 3 and 4 of this book, Price of Inequality, Stiglitz points out that every single line on this slide is demonstrably false. And we're not just talking theory here, he's citing statistical studies which prove that every single one of these statements is false. So before we go further, we need to say what we mean by capitalism, and also instable or unstable. And I'm going to look at a couple of definitions here. This first one is from Webster. It's actually from 1916, the heyday of old style capitalism. Webster defined capitalism as an economic system. The underlines and italics are all mine. I'm just taking this right out of Webster's dictionary, first published in 1916. And the other point is that we are explicitly eschewing government control. Okay? So we don't have government control in good capitalism, and it's an economic system. Now, modern definition, taken from Wikipedia, under capitalism, defines capitalism as a social and economic system. This is different, okay, because now it's not just an economic system. We've had stovepipe thinking in the past. You know, here's economics, here's psychology, here's sociology, and political sciences in Building 13. They don't mix. But now, we tend to look at these various social sciences and say, actually, they are just windows onto one reality. So if you're looking through the dining room window, then that's economical approach. If you're looking through the kitchen window, it's sociological approach, and so forth. But it's the same thing you're looking at. And then secondly, government is always involved. Now, it may be more or less involved, and so we get different types of capitalism, and Wikipedia article pulls out three particular types. ranging from minimal regulation over the pricing mechanism down to maximal, where in state capitalism, the state either owns the means of production, owns some of the factories or something, or at least directs how the factories will operate. Mussolini said that state capitalism was fascist and stood on its head. But I think if you look at the practice, you may find it more difficult to distinguish between fascism and state capitalism. In any case, neither the top nor the bottom are widespread nowadays. What we have almost exclusively is this interventionist approach, or a mixed economy, in which government plays a role to regulate to some extent and correct market failures, among other things. And this whole concept of market failures wasn't present in 1916, because it was assumed that the market was infallible. And we still have some people who claim that the market is infallible. But nowadays, we know better. We've seen it fail. And so as a result, we won't buy that old definition. So we still have this concept of a very conservative ideal form of capitalism in which property belongs to citizens, not the government. People should be allowed to keep what they earn. Profit motives should be allowed to reign free. Regulation and taxation, especially progressive taxation, are illegitimate government interventions and lead to a less efficient marketplace, as the argument goes. And government is not the solution, government is the problem, as one of our presidents said. I'm sure I don't have to tell you which one. What happened to that capitalism? Well, it died in the 20s and the 30s. If you look around the world, you'll see Russia and later China and East Asia went to communism. The East is red. Central Europe, Italy, Spain, and Japan went to fascism. The United States and the Scandinavian countries and the British empires all went to a welfare state. Okay? And it was necessary in order to get out of the Great Depression. And there were many emerging countries that didn't emerge at that point. They simply stayed where they were, underdeveloped, tending to be run by warlords and dictatorships. Now, if I'm right to say that capitalism is intrinsically unstable, whence cometh this assumption that capitalism is stable? Where did that idea come from? And I think that I know, I think it comes from the attempt of Adam Smith and others following him to build a science, because they understood a science along the lines of Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton started with planets in stable orbits around the sun. And there are forces, a balance of force in and out, okay, which keeps them in the stable stable orbits. So we have cycles, we have stability, we have forces that balance each other, and that's necessary in order to have a science, because we're going to pull that stuff apart and show what forces are that operate and what the results are, and then what would happen if we push one side or the other. For example, we have a supply and, a demand curve. They cross at a point, which is an equilibrium, and what happens if you push it one way or the other? Well, the simple assumption is that it will be stable. Okay? Now, Smith knew that government had to be involved to guarantee the continuation of capitalism, and he was quite explicit in saying that. But most people who followed him, the lesser-known ones, were not so clear. Every Economics 101 course, introductory economics course, tend to assume that price is stable at the equilibrium point where supply and demand meet. Okay? And why do they do this? Because it's simple. I'll show you an example of where I do this shortly. Pick a model because it's simple. If we don't make that assumption, then things get messy. And we really don't want to talk about that, especially not in an introductory course. So the non-stable situations or situations without equilibrium just don't get much attention.
Now, recently we've come up with dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models, and I don't want to go into depth in this at all, but what you see is given with the word equilibrium is taken back with the words dynamic and stochastic. The Fed has one of these. It has over 100 variables, and they're all set up in difference equations. So you have to solve more than 100 simultaneous difference equations in order to come to a conclusion about what's going to happen next in the market. And what they find is that several of those variables, which are now intrinsic to their model, are such that a slight variation in any one of them will cause the entire economy to crash and burn. So it's not really so stable anymore. For Milton Friedman, stability was a matter of keeping the government and the Fed from interfering. He likened the American economy to a car, and he said the government and the Fed should be in the back seat, and our job is to keep them from touching the steering wheel. He liked the idea of a stable economy. He's not necessarily assuming it, but he's plunking for it. He's trying to show how you can get there. And the answer, the question that arises, well, you know, if you don't have unstable elements within your understanding of the economy, how do you explain the Great Depression? And he said, well, it was an exogenous shock, that is, an externalism, something from outside that just bashed the economy. And what was that thing from outside that bashed the economy? It was the mismanagement of the money supply. The Fed did the wrong thing. Okay, they upped the interest rate when they should have downed it. Alan Greenspan also thought that the economic markets were stable and would automatically adjust to the shocks that they received. And after the recent meltdown, he acknowledged the error. But actually, almost every major contributor to macroeconomics knew that real economies are not stable. And I'm talking about people like Malthus, Ricardo, and John Stuart Mill, Marx, John Maynard Keynes. All of these people knew that economies are not stable. But nonetheless, we use simple models, and the simple models are stable. That's the problem with the model, not with the economy. So what do we mean by stable? I'm just going to give you some examples of instability and then draw a conclusion from that about what I mean by instability. This peak, this drops down right here, that's the Great Depression, right there. And you'll notice it climbs back up by 1937 when Roosevelt is reelected and decides that now is the time to balance the budget. And it promptly turns around and falls back down into recession again. Eventually, we get out of it, up here, and then we have a bigger drop. Okay, that's not as much a percentage as this drop. But then we have this humongous growth here, and an even sharper drop. Okay, and then another growth here. This looks like it's getting close to 2010. It's not, it's actually 2001. The end was at this point here. You'll see that we were close to a peak right there. We dropped down lower than we had been before. Then we rose up again higher than before. And we dropped down lower than before. And we're going up here. Right now we're up here around 1650 or so in the S&P. This particular drop right here is of interest. This was the point in 2008 when Hank Paulson and Bernanke went to Congress and said, we're on the edge of total collapse of the economic system. Would you please give us $700 billion, no strings attached, tomorrow? And Congress said no. And the next day, the biggest drop we have ever had, 777 points on the Dow. And Congress said, how did you want that? So by instability, I mean the presence of any condition or process which drives some necessary aspect of the economy off a cliff or into subsidence from which it is unable to recover. Now, you might say if it's going to drop down to some very low point and stay there forever, and I'll give you an example of one of those shortly, isn't that stable? And yeah, I guess that's a kind of stability, but considering where it is now and where it might end up, that's not stable from my perspective. Okay, another meaning of stability or instability is any perturbation which causes increasing fluctuations without limit, which we just saw an example of on the stock market. Here's another example. This is the Australian current accounts. You can see that for a while it starts out at zero up until after 1970, and then we start getting some perturbations which get bigger and bigger, and we're also sliding off the cliff. Okay? Which is kind of scary. Okay, but if you'll notice, this is $15 billion, okay, as of about 2012 or so. This is just a trivial amount by comparison to the United States. The United States deficit of debt, actually, is 1,000 times this. And if you look at the world in terms of their current accounts, the United States is the champion, with the greatest deficit, in fact, probably greater than all the rest of the world put together. The people who are winning out are China and Japan, and then Germany is the next. Okay, so some people are making hay with this, but some people are losing their shirts, or about to. But now, obviously, it isn't the size of the debt that matters. It's the relationship of the debt to GDP that matters. Because if you have a big country with a $1 billion debt, that's not so bad as if you have a small country with a small economy that has $1 billion of debt. Now, Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart, a couple of economists, published an empirical study titled Growth in the Time of Debt in 2010. And they found that there was a tipping point when debt reached 90% of GDP. At that point, growth tends to become negative. In other words, countries go into recession. All right. This particular study has been cited by just about every national Republican politician. Okay, all cited this as an example of why we must do something about the debt right away. However, last month, Thomas Herndon, who's a graduate student in economics in the University of Massachusetts, in a paper for his econometric class, got a hold of Reinhart and Rogoff's spreadsheet. And he found an error. In fact, he found several errors, but one in particular, which cut out five relevant countries. And when you fix the error, the growth rate changes from negative 0.1% to positive 2.2%, which is about the same as the other countries, and totally eliminates the whole idea of a tipping point. Okay, so there is no tipping point. And that destroys one of the major arguments for the austerity approach. I also want to talk about the multiplier, the attempts to figure out what the multiplier is and the arguments about the multiplier. But before doing that, I need to talk about what the multiplier is, because not everybody's going to know what we're talking about here. This is the fiscal multiplier given as an example. And John Maynard Keynes came up with these terms like propensity to spend and propensity to save. And if you add the two together, you should get one times the total amount of money that you have acquired. So 0.8 means 80% probable that I will spend it, and 0.2, 80% probability that I will save it. So if the government gives me $100, I'm likely to go spend it. Let's say I spend $80 for groceries. You also assume that not only I have a propensity to spend 0.8, but everybody does. See, this is big simplification, because if I say everybody has a different propensity to spend and save, then it gets hard. It's hard to calculate. Okay, so we'll just assume that we all have the same propensity for the moment. So I spend $80, and the store manager where I spend that takes $54 out of that for partial payment of plumbing. I say partial because plumbing costs more than that nowadays. And she saves $16. And the plumber takes his $54 and saves $10.80 and buys a new pair of shoes for $43.20. And the people that he spent that with, et cetera, and on and on. So what we get is an infinite series here. So the sum of this infinite series is $500. That's assuming that we all have 0.8 as our propensity to spend. Also, over here, the sum of this infinite series is $100. And if each of us gives the government 20% of what we got, the government will get its $100 back. So, gee, this looks great. The government can increase economic activity by a minimum of 500%, you know, just by giving out the cash to somebody who's allowed to spend it. But there's another side to this, too. If the government has been giving me $100 every year, and then one year decides, oops, we don't have it in the budget, cancel that one. Then not only do I not spend mine, but all of these others don't spend theirs, and the net effect is a loss of $500 of economic activity. Okay? So, and there's that possibility as well. Now, Milton Friedman looked at this line of argument. He said, wait a minute, there's a problem with this. If the government gives me $100, yeah, that seems to produce lots of extra financial activity. Okay. However, where did that $100 come from? He said the government had to acquire that somewhere. Perhaps the government borrowed it from some wealthy patron, okay, and gave me that $100. Well, now that wealthy person has $100 less, and that wealthy person is going to adjust his expenditures to match the absence of that $100. And so while the government creates $500 worth of expenses or economic activity there, the lack of that $100 from the other guy creates a negative $500, and the result is a wash. So we don't get anything out of it. So the true multiplier, said Milton Friedman, is probably zero. But to Milton Friedman's credit, he said, we don't have to just argue about this. We can try to measure it. We'll do some statistical studies and find out. Okay? And actually, you know, this is a good idea. The problem is, it's not easy to figure this out. Okay? And I don't think he came up with a value that was worth anything. I think he came up with a positive value, but it isn't that good. The trick is to figure out what that value should be. And now we get to where this becomes significant for current economic approaches. This is a picture of Oliver Blanchard delivering a paper with his colleague Daniel Lay. He is the chief economist of the International Monetary Fund. And his paper was seen as an unofficial apology. He didn't say sorry, but in effect he was saying sorry. The paper shows that fiscal multipliers were consistently and severely underestimated in economic growth forecasts of 2010. Because he said, they all had said, that the fiscal multiplier would be 0.5, which would mean for every $100 the government pumps in, $50 of economic activity occurs. Okay? But now he says 1.5 would be closer, which would mean for every $100, $150 of economic activity would be generated. And a couple of economists in the United States have figured that it should be 2.5. I think it's at least 2. But now, I go to a slide like this, which is my attempt to explain why there's such variation. Okay? Kevin Bucknell is a British economist whom I like because he put out a couple of texts on economics out on the internet, and you can download them for free. he has this curve to show what happens when you try to follow up a suggestion by Keynes that under certain circumstances, classical economics would be a good approximation. It's just that those circumstances don't often obtain. In particular, he's talking about boom time. Okay, so this curve here is a supply curve. Okay, it's an aggregate supply curve, short-term aggregate supply curve. And these curves, which shouldn't be straight, are aggregate demand curves. The reason that this thing bends, usually if you look in an economics textbook, you'll see something that goes like this, okay, as a supply curve. Well, that's unrealistic, okay? And the reason why is because this curve is actually going asymptotic to a couple of limiting cases. The one limiting case is the long-term aggregate supply. That's the maximum that you can get out of the economy with the current set of resources. In other words, all your factories running 100%, everybody employed, everybody working hard, that's the max that they can produce. Well, you can't get more than that. Okay, so when the curve approaches that, it's going to turn upward. And if, so this is a demand curve, if the government at this point decides, okay, we're going to do a little stimulation here of the economy, let's pump some more money in, you get another demand curve that goes like this, okay, which is a little bit to the right of this demand curve. The problem is, though, that the supply curve doesn't move, so all that happens is you end up at this point, and what you've done is inflation. You've inflated the price of everything. And most people, intelligent people, acting rationally, will have figured this out, and so they won't spend that money. They stick it in an overseas bank account or emerging funds fund or something like that to try to get some profit off it. It just disappears from our economy. On the other hand, if you're over here, you're in depression, okay? And now if the government says, well, let's stimulate the economy, we'll draw, you know, a new demand curve here, and you'll notice that it crosses the supply curve here. Well, that means you actually are going to get growth in your real GDP. You're going to get more employment, and you're going to get zero inflation, or very close to zero inflation. So if that's done here, these people tend to be hungry, okay, and they're going to use it. They're going to spend it, what they get. So you'll get a very high multiplier. Okay, and of course in between you have this on the bend, you get a mix. Here's another model. This one also assumes certain stabilities and continuities. Most of the arrows that you see here are following cash flow. There are three that do not. This one here is a flow of labor, which is equal and opposite to the wage flow. Okay. These two down here are import and export, which are following not cash, but goods moving in and out of the country. Apart from those three, they're all cash flows. So if we look at cash on a diagram like this, the neat thing is you can put a pencil anywhere on this diagram, and the flows into this will have to equal the flows out of it. Otherwise, the economy will explode. So at this point, it's not very interesting because what the households spent is what they push into the market. Okay, but if you look here, for instance, then you can start deriving equations. For instance, the yield that goes to the corporation will have to be the sum of the consumption, investment, and government spending. That's assuming that this is trivial. If you don't assume this is trivial, then you have to add one more factor, which is the difference between export and import. Okay? Hyman Minsky, in the 70s, published a paper and then put it out again in his book, which I have around here somewhere. Here it is. Nope, that's not it. Stabilizing an Unstable Economy. One of the early people to point out that the economy is very unstable. He pointed out that after-tax profit on the part of the corporation is actually equal to investment plus government deficit, which I find interesting because so many on the right want to decrease government deficits and hopefully eliminate them without realizing that if you do that, you will also eliminate most American corporations. A couple of other things I want to point to using this model. If a householder spends some money, okay, that money will flow up here down to another householder who then spends it again, and it goes round and round. Okay, this is where the multiplier comes in. On the other hand, if these people are poor and don't have money to spend, why then they don't buy. And if they don't buy, the corporations started laying off people, which of course makes this situation more dire. They have even less money, and the economy spirals down into the ground. One more thing to notice. If these people are poor, then the corporations are not going to be thriving. And these people here, by the way, in 2001, 46% of all profits in the United States corporations were made in the financial sector. They produced nothing tangible, but they made 46% of all profits. They get antsy. They have to do something to keep you know, their salaries coming. So what they do is they start inventing things, like mortgage-backed securities, and collateralized debt obligations, and swaps, etc. We take trash, we slice it and dice it, and we get some company to bless it and call it AAA so we can sell it all around the world. And of course, what happens when you do that is the whole cycle turns to garbage. So some working hypotheses. Capitalism generally involves somebody getting more out in the way of money than they put in. We call that profit. So capitalism, if successful, is a money pump that increases the disparity between the wealthy and the poor. Unless, of course, the poor have a money pump operating in the other direction, which some people say that's government. Or at least that's the job of government. Actually, the Cato Institute has done a study and said that corporate welfare is about 3 times the size of social welfare. So, it won't work that way. Government tends to assist the rich more than the poor. Some of us have acquired very efficient money pumps like Goldman Sachs and ExxonMobil, etc. Capitalist extraction by itself is unstable and leads to collapse. Government, by its transfer payments, has prevented collapse so far. If we didn't have those transfer payments, we wouldn't have an economy. And twice in the past 80 years, we've been on the very edge of disaster, and government both times has saved us from that. So what government does is critical to the survival of the system. But this necessity of government intervention is commonly misunderstood and threatened. I want to talk briefly about Why Nations Fail. This is a very good book by Acemoglu and Robinson. And what they're doing is saying nations fail or become unstable when they have extractive politics or extractive economic systems. There are two types of economic systems, extractive and inclusive. The extractive political systems exist for the benefit of the narrow elite and create an extractive economic system. The masses cannot influence the political system, and so they have no incentives, and creating wealth is taken from them. So this produces a big gap between the rich and the poor, and a couple of kinds of failure, including the iron law oligarchy, which I don't want to go into in detail. I'll give an example. In the 1400s, when the Portuguese and Dutch sailors were sailing down the west coast of Africa, they came across the Congo, and they wrote back and said, "We have never seen people as poor and impoverished as you see here." Now, there are kings, and they're doing okay, but the people as a whole are miserable and the worst we've ever seen. That's in the 1400s. Well, of course, the next thing that happened was the slavery, the attempt to get some of the people on the coast to grab people from further in and send them out, so that was kind of rough on the natives of the Congo. And then, eventually, Leopold I, who was king of Belgium, took over in the Congo and ran it as his personal fiefdom. He tried first to acquire the Philippines, but the Spaniards were already extracting money from the Philippines, so they wouldn't let him have that. So he ended up taking the Congo, and he ran it as his personal fiefdom and came in multimillionaire out of it. First, he had been looking for diamonds and gold, but there wasn't much of that in the Congo. So then he discovered rubber, and they have rubber trees. And so he started having latex accumulation by the natives. Each native was given a quota of latex that they had to provide, and if they didn't provide it, then his thugs from the coast would come in and chop off an arm and make them permanently impoverished.
So, of course, he was getting lots from them. And he became a multimillionaire. Eventually, the rest of the world caught on to what was happening and shamed him into giving it up. At which point the Belgian government took over for a while. It's called the Belgian Congo. But it was declared to be independent and free around 1960 or so, when Mobutu took over from Patrice Lumumba. And he then ran his own version of the extraction system and became a multimillionaire. Okay? And then Kabila overthrew him, and Kabila became a multimillionaire doing this extraction. Okay? So the situation is, you have this iron law of oligarchy. If you have an oligarch and he gets overthrown, you're very likely to have another oligarch with the same structure. Okay? It just continues with a new oligarch. We have, I think most of us are really aware of this. We have this set of knowledge, things like the rich get richer and the poor get children. Money attracts money. This quote from Nehru, the forces of the capitalist society, if left unchecked, tend to make the rich richer and the poor poorer. It takes money to make money, etc. So that's extractionism. And the opposite of that is inclusive politics and inclusive economic systems. And this requires a strong central government. And it requires a strong central government that reflects the interests of the many. If you have only a weak government, it will not do it. For example, Haiti, Somalia, Afghanistan, okay, weak governments, and the result is you don't get any inclusive system. But strong government by itself is not enough. It has to be a strong government that reflects the interests of the many. And this tends to produce a more egalitarian and wealthy society. And then, you know, I could go into how history shapes this, but I won't do that. More on extractionism. Here's a couple of books dealing with this. One by a Pulitzer Prize winner, David K. Johnson, on free lunch. Notice the subtitle: How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Okay, and here's another one that just came out last year by Christia Freeland: Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. And extractionism in America, we have a lot of it. When sequestration affected wealthy travelers, it was fixed. But cancer patients, elderly, poor, Meals on Wheels, look down at towards the bottom here. Over 45,000 well-paid lobbyists in Washington. Many of these lobbyists are earning over $1 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do they earn that because they don't have any effect on politics? No. They earn that because they have a lot of effect on politics. What is the effect they have? They get wealth toward the wealthy. Okay? They set up extraction.
That's right.
Here's an interesting slide that I took from a 2005 study by Larry Bartles. And what he was doing, by the way, the data from this is a relatively inclusive set of data from 1988 to 1992, during the presidency of George Bush the first. And what he's doing is looking at the constituents asking their senators to do something. And what is the result? What is the response on the part of the senators? Well, if the constituent is a middle-class constituent, then there's probably a positive response. If they are a high-income constituent, and you're talking about Democratic senator, you get a little bit better. But if you're talking about Republican senator, you get better than twice the response. On the other hand, if you're poor, you get the shaft, the negative response. Now, I don't think that the senators are responding negatively because these people are poor. I think what this reflects is that you get, 100 people perhaps asking for, safety controls on gun purchases. Let's have a background check. Okay? But you got one that says, no, don't vote that way. And he's rich. And he'll provide a lot of money for the re-election campaign.
Okay, so as a result, these people don't get what they are asking for. They get the opposite. What I've started here is a collection of current issues that are all interrelated in somewhat complicated ways, such that when one of these declines, another one will decline, and it may have feedback on the first or another one, etc. They're all interrelated. Finance, for example, we have reckless provision of credit and the creation of dubious financial instruments. This causes the collapse of the housing and financial markets, which leads to a reluctance of lenders and borrowers to lend and borrow, and this affects the concentration of wealth and employment prospects. Here you have a slide which shows that over the last 30 years or so, we've had an increase in productivity and a humongous increase in the average income of the top 1%. But the average income of all workers, including the top 1%, is pretty flat. If you take the top 1 or 2% out, then this blue line actually declines. Contrary to, you know, the fact that most people who discuss capitalism say that with increasing productivity, you should have increasing wages. wealth concentration also involves political concentration. And this involves the erosion of fair and inclusive market rules, the capture of government for the benefit of the few, extractionism, manipulations of democracy, such as, hey, let's cut out early voting, let's see to it that black people don't vote, etc. Erosion of opportunities for ownership and employment. And as employment drops, consumption drops, which means more layoffs, which means lower employment and lower consumption. And declining wages, declining skills, declining purchasing power, and this is a vicious cycle. It's unstable. The Triffin dilemma I'm not going to go into for time's sake. Just this one thing. Triffin was a Belgian economist who became an American economist, and he testified before Congress that if the United States stopped running its balance of payments difficulty, or payments deficits, that would lead to instability. If the United States did the opposite and continued to have that, that will lead to instability. In other words, you're damned if you do it, damned if you don't. It doesn't matter. We're headed for instability. Mundell's trilemma. Mundell got the Nobel Prize for economics in 1999. He said it is not possible to have monetary independence, free movement of capital, and stable currency exchange rates. And when he said this first, nobody cared, except a few Canadians. But subsequently, we began to see chaos developing in Mexico, in Asia, and so forth. And Danny Roderick's version of this trilemma is that democracy, national sovereignty, and global economic integration are mutually incompatible. So, for example, in Europe right now, the European nations don't want to do away with democracy, so they have a choice. They can either unite politically, or they can disintegrate economically. One or the other. Or they can get rid of democracy. But they're not going to do that. Nowadays, this same thing can be used to show that eventually we will have one world government. It's inevitable. Or we will have economic disintegration. This I found very interesting. Here it is. Galbraith's book on inequality and instability. You notice all of these leading economists say the same thing. He finds that there is a weak correlation between political party and perceptions of equality. Not real equality, but perceptions of equality. Those who perceive the world as roughly egalitarian tend to vote Republican. Those who perceive the world as not egalitarian tend to vote Democratic, or they don't vote at all. They get this discouraged and say, to hell with it. But Republican policies increase inequality, while Democratic policies increase equality. This is negative feedback that produces a stable situation, which splits the country right down the middle. Okay, half Republican, half Democrat. If, for some reason, the middle line moves over to, say, the Republican side, then Republicans get elected, and their policies produce inequality, which produces more Democratic votes, and the middle of the political line moves back toward the Democrats. If the Democrats get a little bit more so that they take over, the result is they produce equality, which produces more Republican votes, and it shifts back toward the Republican side. So it's, you know, it's an equilibrium. The only problem is, if you get divided government that can't do anything, nothing good happens. Which is our current situation. Gallagher cites some empirical studies that show that inequality in income leads to increased unemployment, which leads to increased inequality of income, etc. And this is a vicious cycle. I'll talk a bit about Wilkinson and Pickett's at
the spirit level. This is a very good book.
These two guys are British. But they're British epidemiologists. They're health nuts.
Nuts are healthy.
They show that that societies that are more equal are healthier and happier societies. They show that the relevant variable is not absolute wealth or income, but variation or inequality of income within a nation. What gets worse when rich and poor are too far apart? Health, lifespan, illiteracy, infant mortality, homicides, imprisonment, teenage births, obesity, mental illness, UNICEF index of child well-being, social mobility, and even such basic values as trust and levels of violence. Okay? Practically every social problem that you can name gets worse if you have high inequality. Now, this is his data on inequality. We're only dealing with developed countries here. And it's pretty simple what he does. He takes the top 20%, gets an average value for their salary. The bottom 20% gets an average value for their salary, and does a division to get a single number, which is a measure of the inequality within that society. Okay? And then he graphs. Now, this particular graph is not done that way. This is done by national income per person. Take the whole national income, divide by the number of people, so we get national income per person, and there is no correlation to social problems. Okay? However, if instead of average income, you put income inequality down here, you get a very neat correlation, which is, you know, what I want. The p-value is very low. The probability of the negative hypothesis is less than 0.01. Yeah. 0.05 is the standard. And several of his are 0.05. But this one is even more so. He also shows that you get roughly the same thing, not quite as strong, with looking at the states in the United States. He's got 50 data points. Okay? So he plots the 50 data points and finds that you get a very similar correlation here. I threw this one in. It's taken a copy from his book. The Brits did a study of death rates per 100,000 among working age men by something they call social class of occupation. So the lowest class is unskilled labor, and the highest class is professional doctors and lawyers, etc. We've got a couple of classes in between. And what they found was there is a decided drop in the death rates as you move up the social class of occupation. Now the Swedes, who didn't know what the heck that meant, said, okay, we'll take those same definitions of social class and apply it to our society and see what we get. And this is what they got, the brown ones. You'll notice that in every case, they're better, okay? And they're better because the Swedes have a much more egalitarian society. Okay, but the other thing to notice is the lowest rate in Britain is higher than the highest rate in Sweden. So it's not just that the poor benefit by equality. It's the rich that benefit as well. I'm going to skip by that. Let's talk about, this is actually from 2007. And this reflects what you saw at the very beginning of the presentation. Okay, 80% of the population owns 7% of the wealth. This is not including housing, non-home wealth. There's a professor by the name of Ed Wolf at New York University who keeps a track of this stuff on a website. And here's this, the second from the bottom is 2007, 7% over here. 2010, it drops to 4.7%, a significant drop, okay? But it gets even worse. Pew Research, I think this last month, came out with changes from 2009 to 2011. We don't have stuff more recent than 2011. But as of 2011, the lower 93% of the population in the United States dropped by 4% in their income, whereas, or their wealth, whereas the wealthiest 7% went up 28%. But actually, if you look down here in the fine details, the top of this 93 percentile dropped 6%. And if we assume that there's continuity, then the bottom of this group also dropped 6%. So the very top of this, maybe the top 1/10%, may be going up by 100% or something. It's much worse now. We are headed for a rough ride. Hang on. And I'm done. Okay, questions? Somebody have a microphone?
Yeah, the microphone's over here.
Where is it?
David, you got a...
It's right here.
Yeah, we'll just pass it around.
Next to this post. You got it. Turn it on now.
Now, Jason, you can speak loud. Go ahead.
All right. You refuse to go in depth on the iron law of oligarchy. But I think what it would demonstrate is that an extractive political system is inherently more stable than an inclusive political system. You're nodding.
You're right.
Okay.
In fact,
everything
I said that
has
one
to
of
be going
slides.
Just right for an inclusive political system to be maintained. It only worked here for about 40 years. It worked in England for a little over 30 years.
Maybe.
It's recently failed to work in Southern Europe, and eventually it'll go out of style in Northern Europe, too.
Unless politically we act to prevent that. You're right.
Did you say that corporate profits equal government spending?
Yeah, corporate profits equals investment plus government spending. That's one of the many equations that Hyman Minsky came up with. That was describing, he actually had five different equations.
I thought you said government deficit.
Yeah, what did I say?
You said spending.
I meant deficit.
Right.
Government deficit plus investment equals corporate profit. And that's assuming that you have an active government and very little foreign trade. If you have foreign trade, significant foreign trade, then you have to add another factor for the foreign trade.
And you said they equal each other?
Yeah, the after-tax profits equals investment plus government deficit. So if you eliminate government deficit, you will eliminate a sizable portion of government profits, which of course will kill a lot of corporations.
You mentioned briefly the economic downturn in 2008 and CDO's credit default swaps and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And you did not mention Michael Short's book, Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short, which
yes.
I thought was excellent on explaining it. Could you comment if you thought that was an accurate description of what happened?
It's good. I have read it and I liked it. The only thing is, what you don't see in that is that it isn't so much that some people are stupid and other people are smart. It's that the economic system is created in such a way that we will inevitably attempt to sell garbage.
Standard and Poor's line of credit.
Yes. And they had a reason for it because the investment companies paid them for their evaluation. And they wouldn't pay them unless they got a good evaluation. We could then say, well, you know, the ratings agencies are crooked. Yeah, that's true, but that's not the real reason why this happened. So it's not just that we had some stupid people or some people who got over-leveraged in their houses or bad real estate agents who sold, you know, bad things to people, unsuspecting, or bad rating agencies, or smart short sellers. Yeah, all of those are true. But the real reason for this is the economic structure.
Okay. All right. I'd like to check with you about an assumption that's made by many economists. And it's shown up in my discussions with economists, and I come from a Keynesian background myself. The assumption in the models is that people make rational decisions and make it very interesting in what's called behavioral economics. Is this what you're discovering?
I'm aware of this as well. And of course, people don't behave rationally. it would be nice if they did, maybe, but they don't. But it's a simplification process. It's too complicated to figure out what really happens, so we'll make some simplifying assumptions like that people operate rationally.
I have a question that anybody that knows me knows I have 57 questions that I would actually ask.
I thought you might have one, Carl.
But overall, because you did describe cronyism, mm-hmm. the government, the lobbyists, you talked about the nation's wealth, mm-hmm. as if individuals or companies didn't create it, it's somehow the nation's. But really what I want to, the question is, because you use extraction a lot, mm-hmm. I'm an advocate for freedom. Are you an advocate for freedom? And in which ways, or do we need philosopher kings to tell us how to live? The government. But could you talk about freedom? Because freedom didn't show up, and that's what capitalism is, free markets, free trade, but it was all about extraction.
Freedom is a difficult term, because it means different things to different people. I'm all in favor of freedom, as I understand it, but somebody else may understand it differently. There are some limitations to my freedom. I'm not free to jump over tall buildings at a single bound. I am not free to lift heavy weights. But there are some things that I'm free to do. But they have to be done within a certain context, because the context limits my freedoms. And this is true for everybody. And we don't operate in a non-context. We have to operate within a context. And when you do that, you have to balance some of what you want to do with what somebody else wants to do. Is that enough of an answer? You want to pursue it?
No, I'll let somebody else go. We've talked all that.
I was really happy to see you discuss in the beginning a definition of capitalism. Now, you also got into the financial markets and how so much profit came out of them. So my perception when I looked at history is that debt, finance, preceded capitalism in terms of organized companies, legal charters. So I think debt has been around a lot longer than capitalism. They dance together, but I don't think they're the same. And when you're talking about the instability of capitalism, I wonder if the real point of instability isn't a runaway financial system, where the financial system is, quite frankly, in my opinion, counterfeiting money. If you take a look at an article that Warren Buffett read, where he described the derivatives being weapons of mass financial destruction, he described how both sides of the deal would post profits in their ledgers, but one of them had to lose. So they're lying and pumping up the balance sheets, and this is where a lot of the profits coming from. So I'm wondering if you can see a division between finance and capitalism. And is it fair to think that perhaps this financial system is unstable, not necessarily capitalism?
Interesting possibility. One thing, I agree with you that finance pre-existed before capitalism. Yeah, I was talking about capitalism, which includes finance. If you look at early versions, early understandings of capitalism, such as Smith and Ricardo, Malthus and so forth, they never mentioned finance. It's not, or at least it's not key to them. If you look at these diagrams, for example, on this diagram, we put in a financial market, but the early versions of this didn't have a financial market. That just somehow kind of happened. We didn't bother to try to figure out how it happened. Now, I think that the ideal form of capitalism has had a significant impact on how the financial market is structured. So I think that we're still talking about capitalism.
In other words, capitalism existed before capitalism
came
to be.
Before it was defined.
Okay, Lynn. You talked about equilibrium, and the thing about irrationality has been, and in fact, that was the other assumption that I got in my college economics class, was the assumption of rationality, which totally made the professor incredible. But the other thing that I guess we really didn't hit on, you didn't touch on overtly, although I think Carl kind of got close to it a moment ago, is about information, the quality and the availability of information. So in the so-called free freedom, on the one hand, for instance, the credit rating agencies were free to put forth ratings which their clients paid them to provide. They were free to do that. At the same time, there were the people who bought the derivatives were free to either buy them or not buy them. But what kind of information did they base it on? One of the more notorious stories was about the municipality in Norway that ended up
they only bought because it was rated AAA. So the rating is crucial to the saleability. And of course that's why it was important for Goldman Sachs to pay the rating agencies to get the type of rating they wanted.
But I could argue that municipality was free not to buy those derivatives.
But they were uninformed.
So they went ahead and made an irrational decision because they were uninformed, but they went ahead and bought them anyway.
Well, yeah, but you could say it's rational because on the basis of the information they have, it's a good deal.
Well, you trusted me.
Yeah.
Kind of deceived.
Yes. But that's not necessarily rational.
Okay, question.
Yeah.
Yes.
It seems like that if we go on the gold standard would simplify a lot of this, a lot of the trust and so forth, and take people's word for it. Now, a lot of it would still be there, but what about a gold standard that takes a few years to work its way down to push itself out, however much gold there is, it doesn't matter, it's divided up proportionally. So, comment on that.
Okay, Milton Friedman, in his book on monetary history of the United States, gave the evidence for the fact that those countries that stayed on the gold standard suffered until they got off. Those countries that got off the gold standard rapidly suffered least. And the least suffering was by China, that was not even on the gold standard, they were on the silver standard. So every economist since 1963 has understood that you cannot run a national economy on gold. There is no effort anywhere among rational economists to do so. It's counterproductive.
When this was pointed out a while ago about the inherent irrationality and the psychology involved with economic systems, and this was pointed out to me very dramatically 5 or 6 years ago when this recession started, when the pundits, as everybody was screaming, recession, recession, recession,
Texas had full employment. You know, our housing hadn't gone anywhere. We were pretty happy down here, except, you know, everybody got, quote, scared, you know, by all this hysteria, you know, that was started up in the East, you know, by the media. So what happened? People stopped spending money. And they stopped spending money out in the stores and in the doctor's offices or here and there. And sure enough, businesses had to lay off people. Mm-hmm. And then you had this downward spiral. All because of psychology, mass psychology. That's what happened in Texas, of course. And I saw it. It affected my you know, my practice. People just stopped spending disposable income, you know, and just kind of sat on it.
Remember, part of what I was saying early on was that we need to avoid so-far thinking.
Yeah.
When you look at things in terms of psychology, you're looking at the same thing that you're looking at economically.
Right.
So yes, psychology plays an important role. And I have a file here with a quotation from Gordon, I guess, History of American Capitalism, in which he says, hey, if anybody had any doubts about the psychological impact on capitalism, you only need to look at what happened when Roosevelt became president. And he calls this meeting of the press and 125 reporters crowd into the Oval Office. And he says, we're going to fix this. And everybody cheers and so forth. And then he closes all the banks in the country. And then he tells the people, when the banks open, they will be safe. Safer than your mattress. So take your money back and put it in the bank. And people did, because they believed him. And this is, you know, the salvation of capitalism via psychology. And you're right, this, you know, it's a big deal.
What I'm taking away from this is that a well-regulated capitalism is the solution to the laissez-faire capitalism. And all of our problems in capitalism comes from the fact that there's not enough government regulation. And, you know, the Republicans are calling too much government regulation, but that's actually what's going to save capitalism.
I think
that's
you're right.
That's what I got from it. Am I wrong?
Yes, I think you're right. Of course, it is possible that we can over-regulate and destroy capitalism. That way.
The Texas example, I think, is a good one. It's right. The Texas
use the mic.
It is right that Texas experienced less of the recession at the beginning than it did later on. And the reason was that until, I forget, I think it was 1997 or 1998, Texas had a law that prevented people from taking out the equity on their mortgages. You could not refinance in Texas to take out equity on your mortgages. So Texas was less severely affected by the financial crash than the rest of the country.
I'm sure you're right.
Let's take about two more questions, I guess. Let's get this to the other question. This guy first.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
At the beginning of your audio lecture, you spoke about capitalism and that it's not only an economic system, but it's also a social system. This is not an original thought of mine, but it's something that's very current. Just the other day, I was listening to some broadcast, and it simply said that we have reached a historic level in this country of youth unemployment. And you think about that, and you're projected, you may have a generation here that's growing up who will never have experienced employment and all of the negative ramifications that will do for a generation and even though the children of this current generation. So I'm believing that rightfully so, the government must intervene or should intervene, because what we're going to do I mean, I think it's something that maybe FDR did, a youth program or something, to get this current generation, which is suffering more than any generation, into the labor market. And I will say, okay, that was my question, how you feel about that. And I think you introduced us to a person named economist Wilson and Pickett, and it falls right into that. And then one quick comment, which is strange about, I mean, I think about Texas and things like that. Also, I guess the news story said that of the 50 states, Oklahoma was number 9 in FEMA grants. And I thought, well, that's a very low tax state, but it ranked ahead of 41 other states in receiving grants from the government. That's okay.
Yeah, you're right. I agree with it, you know, all of that first part. I'm not sure about Oklahoma. But,
number 9 in grants.
The problem of youth unemployment is severe. That's why I was saying, hold on, because we're going to have a bumpy ride. And you look at some places in Europe where youth unemployment is over 50% right now. They are seriously in danger.
Okay, last question. You demonstrated that there was no economic tipping point in terms of the national debt, but there is a political tipping point in terms of the iron wall of oligarchy. And what makes you think that we haven't already crossed into a infinitely stable, extractive political system?
I don't think we have. That's. I think there's still hope. Maybe I'm just being optimistic. I don't know. But you wouldn't get that from listening to the presentation because it was kind of downer, you know, frequent downer. But I still am somewhat optimistic.
Okay, that's it.